Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. So today, I will be discussing pharmaceutical-related warning letters and letters of violation released by the FDA between 1997 and 2010. I'm presenting this on behalf of a group from the International Center for Pharmaceutical Economics and Policy at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy in Boston, in collaboration with the School of Public Health and Health Sciences at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. None of the authors have any personal financial relationships to disclose at this time. So the outline of the presentation today will include the background, the objectives, materials and methods, results, conclusions, limitations, and policy recommendations. Let's start now with the background. The FDA enforcement activities are essential functions of the FDA's regulatory and enforcement role in protecting public health, in particular, assuring the safety, effectiveness, and security of pharmaceuticals. These activities include seizures, injunctions, inspections, warning letters, and product recalls. I will further break these activities down in a future slide. Warning letters are FDA notification about violations of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, otherwise known as the FDCA, and related regulations. They may be documented by the FDA during its inspections or investigations. Warning letters are issued for violations of significant regulatory status, meaning those that may actually lead to an enforcement action if the documented violations are not corrected. The warning letter is really one of the FDA's principal means of achieving prompt voluntary compliance with the FDCA. These are the type and sources of the FDA warning letters. There are essentially two types of warning letters. The first is the warning letter, which is of significant regulatory violations, and the second type is the untitled letter, which is less serious in offense. These letters may be issued by either the headquarters or the district offices. Let's move on to the objectives of the study. The objectives of the study was twofold. First, to assess the trends in pharmaceutical-related warning and untitled letters released by the FDA headquarters between 1997 and 2010, a 14-year period. And second, to characterize and assess differences in the number and type of warning letters released during the second Clinton administration, the two George W. Bush administrations, and the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Now let's talk about the materials and methods. The data sources for this study derived from the FDA webpage. Two researchers collected from each letter information about the FDA division releasing the letter, the date which it was released, the company to which it was addressed, and the particular drug-related violation. The letters were from January 1997 to December 2010. In regards to the methods, all the letters were classified according to federal administration during the study period, and descriptive statistics was performed for the analysis. Let's move on to the results now. Here we have the FDA enforcement activities listed below between 1997 and 2010. As you recall, these activities include inspections, recalled products, warning letters, seizures, and injunctions. As you can see, inspections make up the greatest proportion of the activities, totaling about 253,000, with an annual average of 18,000, followed by recalled products at about 72,000, with an annual average of about 5,000. Below that, you can see that there were 10,329 warning letters issued during this 14-year period. It's important to note that these 10,329 letters include both those that were issued by the FDA headquarters, and district offices from the various FDA divisions regulating food, drug, and medical devices. Of these 10,329 letters, only 1,180 letters were released from headquarters, and our study will focus on this subset of letters. And then the rest of the letters were released by, were of the activities below, seizures and injunctions. This next slide here categorizes the warning and untitled letters released by the FDA headquarters between 97 and 2010, according to the FDA division that issued them. Now remember that we are looking at the 1,180 letters released by headquarters here. As you can see, the Division of Drug Marketing, Advertising, and Communications released 820 letters, making up the greatest proportion at about 70%. Scientific Investigations Division released 113 letters at about 10%, and the Division of Office of Compliance released 105 letters at about 9%. And then the rest of the letters were released by the divisions below. Now this slide here shows the distribution of the 1,180 letters released by headquarters and the trend over time. As you can see, the x-axis denotes the years between 97 and 2010, and the y-axis denotes the number of letters released. The number of letters were greatest during the second Clinton administration, then declining during the George W. Bush administrations, and then increasing again during the Obama administration, at least the first 2 years. Here we can see the number of the average number of letters released per administration. The average number of letters released during the second Clinton administration was about 142 letters. The average during the George Bush administrations was about 49 letters, and the average during the first 2 years of the Obama administration was about 112 letters. That is a difference in average of 93 letters between the Clinton and Bush years, and a difference of about 62 letters between the Bush and the Obama years. Here we have a visual of the differences in the average number of letters released. The number of letters released peaked in 1998 at 183 letters and subsequently dropped the next year to 123 letters, continuing to decline to a steady level during the George W. Bush administration before increasing during the first 2 years of the Obama administration from 44 in 2008 to 117 in 2009. It is notable that the decline and the number of letters seen during the George Bush administration began in the last 2 years of the second Clinton administration. This slide here shows the distribution of letters from headquarters released specifically by the Division of Drug Marketing, Advertising, and Communications, and the trend over this 14-year period. If you recall, the Division of Drug Marketing, Advertising, and Communications released about 70% of the letters from headquarters. The x-axis denotes the years between 1997 and 2010, and the y-axis denotes the number of letters released. The number of letters released also peaked in 1998 here at 162 letters before declining to 108 letters in 1999, and then continuing to decline through the Bush administration, at which point in 2008 it increased again from 21 to 43 during that first year of the Obama administration. So it's notable that the trend that we saw with all of the letters from headquarters is very similar to the trend we see here in the particular Division of Drug Marketing, Advertising, and Communications. Yes. Yes, so we haven't looked exactly into all the factors that may contribute to the decline in numbers, but definitely staffing is a possibility to explain why this decline might have happened.
I know after 9/11 there was
Right. So there are many divisions. So that, you know, and one possible explanation would be that certain divisions are more active than others. All right. So we'll move on now to the conclusions. From our results, we found that most warning letters and letters of violation were related to marketing and advertising activities of pharmaceutical companies. We also saw that the number of letters was related to the federal administration. We saw that the greatest number of letters were released during the second Clinton administration and then declined during the George W. Bush administration and then increasing in the Obama administration. In regards to some policy recommendations, we see that an assessment of the impact of changes in federal administration on the actual enforcement activities is required. We also see that there is a need for a system in place to ensure the independence of the FDA's regulatory affairs. Some of the limitations of our study: information about the budget and resources dedicated to enforcement activities in each administration was not available. In addition, information about other additional informal FDA communications with the companies were not released by the FDA. Thank you very much for your attention.
Megda wants to make a DPPS announcement first, and then we'll have a discussion.
So thank you very much, everyone, for attending. This program is brought to you by the Drug Policy and Pharmacy Services Committee, which is a part of the medical care section of the APHA. We have these flyers that we send around, and there's also a sign-up sheet if you would like to be on our mailing list. We just do newsletters about four times a year. There's no excessive emailing or no solicitations of any kind, so be assured. But we would definitely like to see you at the meeting, which is tonight at 6:30 in, where is that again?
Franklin Square.
It's here. In the Franklin Square Hall here in this room. Yes, I'm sorry.
When you finish, I have a comment about the developing world.
All right. And hopefully we'll see some of you there. It's at 6:30 p.m. tonight. And we're going to talk about next year's programming, so any of your thoughts will be appreciated. There's a Google Groups link as well as my email on the flyer, so if you would like to contact me about anything in general with related to DPPS, APHA, please feel free to do so. Thank you very much for your attention.
Yeah, my comment is going to the development of the world, one has to be very careful because drugs, they are not well regulated as it is over here. So many of them cut drugs all over the place. They get some adulterated medications from China, from India. And also, money is involved in the clinical trial. Some patients want to get the money. Some don't understand very well the informed consent. So if you want to go to the developing world, better you go to the university teaching hospitals. Even though everybody's going to clamor, they want to participate. So these things need to be checked before you start doing that. Some doctors write prescription for patients. They don't write what they're giving. They don't discuss it in full. Some doctors will see a patient. They have a table with medication. They don't involve the pharmacist. So these things have to be well, you know, checked because of the ethical implications. You know. It's easy to go in. Money is involved.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, the literature view that was done, I guess, that might have been you. The best literature on the offshore research is in newspapers. Mm-hmm. Chris Humley did a great series at the St. Petersburg Times. It's on the web, you can get its video. There will be a large major network expose on Indian CRO research sometime in the next few months.
Mm-hmm.
The ICH, you should know, is an industry organization controlled by industry, so that's why the regulations exist that way. There's a paper that I can give you on the document.
That would be very nice.
The interesting thing about the inspection rates is that Abrams was in charge the whole time. You need to distinguish the warning letters from just the notice letters. Because two things happened. One was they flipped, they went from warning letters to notice letters. Companies don't care about notice letters. They only care about warning letters. And it's negotiated. I can get you the negotiations documents because I have them from about six different drug companies through litigation.
Okay, that's Diane.
I'm in Alabama. And ethics, the problem with, you can't rely on ethicists, you certainly shouldn't use the research. Their main source of income is by calling unethical things ethical for corporations and insurance companies, etc. That's how they make a living, okay, by calling unethical things ethical. So you can't, their literature is always going to be weak because they need to make a living and you're not paying them. The drug companies are paying them to say that whatever unethical thing they're doing is kosher. So they're essentially bought and sold rabbits.
So Dorothy and David, thank you very much for your comments, and your point is very well taken. However, I honestly don't believe that a lot of emphasis exists on CRO payrolls. And so whatever ethical comments or whatever it is that they're saying that this is what is kosher is actually just coming from somebody who's doing the research. When you have that high level of involvement from the trial sponsor, from the CRO in the research, it's hard to distinguish the ethics of it. And that's why what we're saying is we actually need this overarching third independent party that's going to come up with this greater ethical code that needs to be enforced in a legal fashion, because ethics means nothing if you can't enforce it. If there's no redress for people to seek, then it really doesn't mean much. It can just be turned around. So, thank you very much.
Joel?
Yeah. So, a couple of comments again about your piece. So, one of them is that there's a fair amount, as David was saying, but there's a fair amount of gray literature about clinical trials in developing countries. So, you might want to look. There are a couple of Dutch NGOs that have done a lot of documentation. They put out publications about clinical trials and how they're used by the European Medicines Agency for approval. The second point is that in the US, the last step I saw said that only about a quarter of the clinical trials were being done in academic centers and 75% had been in the community. So even in developed countries, clinical trials are not primarily being conducted in academic centers.
But they all have academic authors.
Well, they may have academic authors if they're published.
They're on the payroll.
Well, they need somebody to sign the ghostwritten paper who's got stats.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, about the developing countries, and the reason why I said academic institutions is because these are the places where you will see the most needy people, the people who actually mostly need the medications, and this is the public that you can actually easily reach out to. The ethics of it really is questionable as to whether it's more ethical to do it in for-profit versus non-for-profit, but realize that in developing countries, the for-profit sector is purely a business model. It's purely a business proposition. There is really very little or absolutely no oversight going on as to what's happening within that center. So in that respect, pairing up or having some sort of academic involvement might actually be a little bit better than having no involvement at all. So that's really where I was going with that.
Well, if you look at Alan Hornblum's book, Acres of Skin, and some other U.S. examples, public health service being comparable to academic, the worst, most egregious human exploitation and research protocols have been done by academics.
Yeah.
The worst. Okay, and it's not close. It's, so it's Tuskegee and University of Pennsylvania. That's where we are. That's, we're close to it.
So we all know that academics are not a business model.
Absolutely. And they're all virgins.
That's right, yes. Okay, yeah. Other questions for the other panelists?
I have some very basic questions. I'm going to hold you this a little long. First of all, right sensor. Could you tell me what that means, right sensor?
Yes. What is right sensor?
Yes, what does that mean?
It's for the new drug application approvals in the 2000, especially from 2005 to 2009, because the data we have for the patent life, we think it's not accurate yet because, you know, because of policy implementation, the patent extension and the exclusive they're going to add it to the patent life is not yet approved. So we get rid of this data from 2005 to 2009 in our analysis.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the other question I had was untitled letters. What does that mean, untitled letters?
Yes. So when you look at the letters issued by the FDA, the warning letters themselves will have in bold type at the top, warning letter, versus the untitled letter has no such bolded format. And really the distinction is the warning letter is much more significant, much more serious in nature, and the company is responsible to respond within X number of days, usually 30 days, with a plan, an action plan to rectify whatever violation they had committed. Whereas the untitled letter is more of, it's more informal in nature and telling the company, look, we see something wrong with what you're doing. Please, like, change it. But there's no commitment that the company really has to address to that.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
It's like a speeding ticket warning.
Yes.
Yeah. And these are all letters to. I'm a practitioner, so I'm just
okay.
These are letters
yeah.
to the drug companies. We often get letters to the practitioners.
Yeah.
Saying this product, here's a new warning out. That's post, was that usually post marketing surveillance?
Yeah.
And say, oh, by the way, it kills people too, kind of thing?
Yeah. We've known this for 5 years, but we thought we'd tell you now.
Right.
I don't have empirical evidence on that, but the warning level letters tend to get a little more attention from Bloomberg Business, which affects price of stock.
Okay.
The other stuff, you know. Wall Street doesn't pay attention to. Okay, Maggie.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry, I missed some of these. I'm just curious, how many of you are planning to publish what you've done?
They're all doctoral students or junior faculty, yeah, so sure.
I'm here to solicit these papers.
All right, good. Yes?
Just one more basic question again. Does anyone in the audience or anywhere know how many countries allow direct-to-consumer advertising, like in television?
Two.
Two, I thought.
Yeah.
Just two.
New Zealand.
And it's more limited than New Zealand.
That's the problem.
I believe Indonesia allows it too, if I'm not mistaken.
I think when people cite those two, they usually mean the industrialized countries.
Yes. Joel?
So yeah. The other thing about the warning letters and the change was not just the volume, but how long it took the warning letters to get out. So under Bush, they changed the way that they were issued, and then had to be approved by the FDA General Counsel, who at that point was Troy, I think.
Yeah, Dan Troy.
And that delayed. So previously they had gotten out a lot quicker. Under Troy, they took a couple of months to get out. So you had much; they were much less effective.
Yeah.
Effective.
Yeah, and cutting that data, another variable would be the commissioner, because and when the commissioner gets confirmed and feels a little more gutsy for doing some things to try to look at that, because that would be interesting to see how that affects, you know, enforcement. Yeah.
Just one more comment about the staffing. Staffing went up all this time in DDMAC, which is the main generator. We went up. When they first started doing this surveillance, I went to a meeting and met with, I think, the entire staff, which was five, to monitor all advertising. And now I think they almost have 30.
Yeah, it's about 30.
Okay, so
yeah.
To monitor only about 100 million pieces of advertising.
That's right.
But, you know, they really work hard. And that's so staffing isn't an issue, but what is an issue, during this time period, 2000 to 2002, Honig, who was the head of DDMAC, was in negotiations for a job with Merck. While he was in charge of receiving the post-marketing surveillance data. So for that, basically a whole year, he was negotiating his exit from the FDA and a contract with Merck. And so some of the staffing issues are more subtle than just numbers.
Oh, of course.
Okay, and you can't know what I just told you unless you have the deposition from the Merck litigation. Although I put it on the web, but who gets that? So you have to look at that kind of detail to really understand how they're manipulating things. Because also on the warning letters, usually before it goes out, they'll enter into negotiations with the company. And so now here you have the guy Merck is trying to hire, negotiating with the company about input into the warning letter on the stuff that he's in charge of regularly. Mm. You see, it's very complex to negotiate with yourself.
And that was one of the limitations we cited.
Okay, what?
That was one of the limitations.
Yeah, but it's not such a limitation. All this data is available.
Okay.
Mm. It's gettable. I mean, yeah. I have a lot of it. Yeah. Other people have it. It's gettable. It needs to be pulled and put into literature.
Yeah,
she's
we'll
100% correct. Huh?
Hopefully we'll speak after.
Enrique?
I have a couple of questions for Jennifer. The first one is, how do you define day supply? And the second question is,